in the 2016 election that people who are over the age of 65 were the ones who are sharing 7 times more links to political fake news compared to younger adults.
Wow.
On Facebook, and that adults over 50 were overrepresented among super shares on Twitter. So they were responsible for over 80% of fake news shares.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out our podcast, Understanding Our Place in the World. The podcast is brought to you by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. My name is Philip Cosolino, and I am an experimental social psychologist at Essex, and my guest today is Dr. Vanessa Loaiza. She's a cognitive developmental psychologist at Essex. Vanessa researches memory and complex cognition across the adult lifespan, with a particular interest in the processes that allow us to hold information in our minds from moment to moment, and how we retrieve that information later on. Vanessa and I spoke recently about a number of topics, including the surprising effect that distractions can have on our memories, as well as what we can do to enhance our memories. And we even discussed memory processes related to the spreading of so-called fake news. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Vanessa, thanks for coming on the podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Philip. It's a pleasure.
Tell me a bit about your background.
As you can hear, I'm a fellow American, and I got into psychology as an undergraduate at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, where I grew up. And I had a mind to do counseling, clinical therapy type stuff, as many people do. But actually, I ended up changing courses, and I got really interested in cognitive psychology and brain and behavior. I just took those kinds of courses. And then I also started doing research as an undergrad too. And so from there, I really decided to become an academic in a university lecturer. And I went to Colorado State University for my master's and PhD directly after undergrad. And I studied cognitive psychology there. And after I finished graduate school in 2012, I did a couple of postdocs in Switzerland. So that's what brought me originally across the pond. And then, to my surprise, really, I got offered a job at Essex in 2015. So I've been here ever since.
Excellent. All right. So, I know Loyola Marymount. I spent some time in Southern California, which is lovely. And Colorado is beautiful. So you had some really, and then Switzerland, my goodness, you've been to some lovely vistas while you were educating yourself.
Yes, definitely.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your PhD work? What was your sort of, you know, you can step us through however you'd like to, the thesis work that you did there at Colorado State.
It's funny. I've been thinking about the fact that actually, a lot of what I've been working on, even from my very first year, has been pretty consistent, even across my career. So I was interested in studying working memory, which is our ability to hold information in mind and do stuff with that information. So it's kind of like our mental workspace. So we are often just kind of trying to keep information in mind from moment to moment and work with that information. Whether it's not just trying to remember a phone number, but also, you know, if you're trying to multiply two numbers together, if you're trying to follow along a conversation and respond, but at the appropriate time and all of these things, you know, you're juggling all of these different tasks in the service of some goal. And so I was interested in that and exploring how that works and what are the processes that allow us to do that. And then how does that impact our ability to retrieve that information later on. So right now we're having a conversation, but what makes it likely that later on we remember, you know, details from this conversation that we have stored in long-term episodic memory? And I've been looking at that, yeah, like I said, basically since I started. And I even had a sort of a first-year project looking at how there's often times that we become distracted in working memory, you know, our attention gets distracted by something else. And we sort of have to think back to what it was that we had in mind just a moment ago. And I'm really fascinated by that. And what we had sort of been looking at in this research, even from my first year, is that even though that's quite a struggle when you get distracted, you're more likely to remember that information later on in long-term memory than if you hadn't been distracted at all. So that's something I did in my first year, but I literally just published a couple of papers on it this year. So I'm still working on that, my first year project, I'd say.
So are you telling me that really what we should do is if we're trying to remember things is we should seek out distraction?
No, I wouldn't say that. And in fact, the sort of account that we proposed for this, or I should say my advisor proposed and I worked on, was that, you know, you are doing things to try to recover that information. You're thinking back, we say covertly retrieving it back into your mind.
So you know you were distracted.
Yes, but there's other things that you could do that make it more likely that you remember information over the long term that also might explain this effect. Like the fact that, you know, maybe by becoming distracted or by having that time, that space in between things that you're trying to remember, you can elaborate more on them. You can kind of do some more sort of associative techniques to try to remember this information. So it might not have anything to do with the distraction per se. So I wouldn't recommend that you should go distract yourself now. It was just more this interesting, like, counterintuitive finding that, my goodness, like, how is it that, like, you're distracted and somehow you're more likely to recall that information than never having been distracted.
So then you left Colorado, you went to Switzerland, and Switzerland was your postdoc?
Yes. I worked at the University of Fribourg for 2 years with Valerie Kamos. And yeah, she does also basic working memory research, but she's also interested in this thinking back to information you had just encountered just a moment ago, and how that is involved in working memory, if at all, because actually some people disagree about whether that's a thing. And also if that impacts long-term memory. And then I changed to the University of Zurich, working with Klaus Oberauer, and that was for a little less than a year. And I also was working on this topic, and he's one of these people who's a bit more skeptical of that, which is fun. These two people have two different models of working memory. So sometimes people kind of laugh when they hear who I've worked with, because I've had a diversity of views in my training. So
that's really good, actually.
Yeah, it's good.
So this is, would you call this retrospective processing of memory? Is this some sort of like, what is the term you might use for it?
The term we've used is refreshing, attentional refreshing. So you're using, it's not like you rehearse or repeat the information over and over, but you're using your attention to think back to the information you just had in mind.
Where are you sort of at now? What are the directions you're going in and have been going in since you've, you know, maybe, as you said, it's probably some of this is similar and some of the same work, but is there a different approach that you've been taking as a professional in the business?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of the work is on the similar topic about how we retain information in working memory and also over the long term, but it just manifests a bit differently too. So for example, construct of refreshing I just mentioned, you know, one thing I've thought about it is that maybe refreshing works in working memory by basically reinforcing the information that we're trying to keep in mind with associated details. So, you know, that you're talking with me now about this topic, and it's me on this day at this time with this weather and you know, other things are going on, all of these different associated contextual specific details. And that refreshing helps to reinforce those bindings, those associations we have between that the content of that information and its details. And so one way I've looked at this is basically trying to see, does refreshing actually impact, you know, that the likelihood that you can retain those details later on? So one way that we've looked at this is by looking at source memory. So this is memory for the original contextual or the original source of the information that you're trying to remember. So if I present some word pairs to you, and I, you know, it's like pink cop or something. And then the words disappear, and then one of them is repeated. So it says cop on the right-hand side. And in another situation, cop isn't repeated. There's just sort of a little dot that asks you to think back to that word cop and come up with it yourself. So now I'm specifically asking you to refresh that information. Is it more likely that you can remember that cop was on the right-hand side of the screen, that was a sort of an associated detail later on? And also that cop was in this unrelated word pair compared to, you know, if I said pink, blue, you know, and then you're trying to remember blue now later on when I asked you about blue, that it was in a related pair and was on the right-hand side. And so we've done this with younger and older adults because we were interested in whether older adults, the sort of source memory deficit that they have that's been well documented has to do with maybe a refreshing deficit that they can't actually focus their attention in working memory, and this causes them to have deficits in long-term episodic memory. What was interesting in that study is that older adults, they did have a source memory deficit for, you know, where the information was on the screen, like that it was in the left or the right-hand side of the screen. They weren't very good at determining that, but they were just as good as younger adults at remembering the relatedness source, that they could distinguish that the word came from a related or an unrelated pair just as well as younger adults. So that was pretty cool because it suggested to us that this deficit in long-term episodic memory, it's not just a monolithic deficit that is universal across everything. You know, they're really able to still have some preserved types of memory for things that are more meaningful in this case.
Right. And what the deficit was in, to some extent, sort of ancillary contextual information, but it wasn't necessarily the core part of the task they had been given.
Yeah, you're right that the arbitrary details were just not there compared to these more meaningful details.
So let's talk a little bit about your work in that specific context of looking at aging and memory and what work you've done, and sort of just tell a story about what you've learned.
Yeah, it's a major area of research for me, and it really goes hand in hand with my other work. And what this work has shown, not just my work, but other work too, has shown that, you know, there are areas in which that older adults for sure struggle. You know, we can see that just anecdotally that, you know, older adults will complain about having, you know, more memory difficulties and things of that nature. But again, it's not just, you know, a universal decline. You know, there are areas in which that older adults actually excel. So my favorite thing to explain is that, you know, they have great vocabulary, great knowledge, great world knowledge compared to younger adults. And this is what we call semantic memory or crystallized intelligence. So it's more, you know, accumulated knowledge through their lifetimes.
A poet might call it wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I was just lecturing about wisdom. You would think that, because that's also sort of a stereotype we have about aging. It's like
exactly.
Older, wiser person. But that's the thing about wisdom in this research that I was reading and presenting to my students in my aging module, is that it doesn't, just because you're older doesn't necessarily make you wiser in all things. It has to be sort of wisdom that's most relevant to what you know. So in a way, it's like if, you know, if you don't have a lot of knowledge in a certain domain, then you're not necessarily going to be wiser at it just because you're older, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
Let's talk about this sort of positive side of getting older that you're talking about, this aging and knowledge, and, you know, vis-a-vis aging and memory. So dig in a little deeper there and talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, older adults can show that they excel in these areas overall. But it's also interesting for me as a researcher, too, because I've paid a lot of attention to the fact that, you know, if we can see that older adults have these benefits, then is there a way that we can incorporate that into sort of making them basically incorporate those benefits so that they buttress against, you know, sort of the decline that they see in other areas in episodic memory. And so that was sort of the idea with this work, that, you know, about the source memory and trying to remember, you know, details that are actually meaningful and semantically relevant, because we know that older adults will basically have these very dense semantic networks because of that, you know, accumulated knowledge and experience and education. And so perhaps we can use that to sort of, you know, bolster their episodic memory deficits.
And have you have demonstrated that that is possible, that there is a way.
Yeah.
To...
Yeah. And the other thing too, is that a different study that I published this year, we showed that, you know, actually trying to adapt the information that people are studying and working memory by basically what we did is we presented these word pairs to younger and older adults. And we had them try to remember these word pairs from working memory. And the task was adaptive so that if they started to show low performance in the task, then we gave them a semantically related pair. And these were really weakly related. So it wasn't like table chair. It was like sort of a little bit milder than that, so that we could get younger and older adults to be similar to each other, to show similar performance in working memory. And what we showed is that this actually helped to improve older adults' long-term episodic memory in turn, so that they showed similar long-term episodic memory as younger adults. So it's almost like pointing to the fact that, you know, we can sort of rely on this intact semantic memory that older adults have to try to adapt the information that they're learning, that they're trying to hold in mind, so that they too can show relatively similar memory ability later on as a consequence. So it's just trying to, ameliorate those deficits.
We're kind of leading in the direction of, we're talking about strategies and ways in which, you know, deficits can be overcome or at least enhanced. These promises of people selling games, devices, programs that say we can enhance your memory. Don't worry, older folks, we can save your memory if you do these things. If you go through this, is that true? Is there an element of memory improvement out there that we could look to?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and there is work on this. And the short answer is basically that if you enjoy brain training games and apps and stuff for fun, then by all means, like, have fun with those apps and stuff. I personally have a 213-day streak on Duolingo practicing my Spanish. So, because I enjoy it, I like learning, brushing up on my Spanish and making sure that that's intact and stuff. But I shouldn't be assuming that practicing Spanish with Duolingo is going to improve my memory, or at least, ward off the chances of me getting dementia. So, as you said, there are a lot of claims out there, and basically my view is that the evidence is not quite so strong for those strong claims. So I think there are plenty of things you can do for free that costs nothing to improve your memory and cognitive ability.
Excellent. What are those?
So the number one thing.
You had me at free, but let's go from there.
Yeah. The number one thing I would say to anyone listening and otherwise, I always say, is to exercise, to physically exercise. So of course you can do mental exercise if you want, and it's fun to do, but, you know, just, if you want something that is clearly effective, it's physical exercise.
So physical exercise is good for memory. Talk about that.
We know that it benefits, physical activity benefits your, you know, physical stature and your reduced likelihood of getting, like, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and stroke and all of these things. But we know that it has cognitive and memory benefits as well, because essentially, by engaging in aerobic exercise, you're improving not just your physical health, but in particular, this this thing we call a VO2 max. So it's basically your maximal oxygen uptake. And that indicates your blood flow of, and delivery of oxygen to all over your body, including your brain. And so it's a measure that we have of people's aerobic or their physical fitness. And that tells us some things about their physical abilities as well. But what's important is that we know that this is, you know, having a good maximal oxygen uptake is important for stimulating areas of the brain that we know are actually susceptible to declines as we grow older. So areas like the hippocampus, for example, tend to decline as we grow older in terms of its just structural integrity, how much volume you have there. And we know that, you know, by engaging in aerobic fitness and increasing your VO2 max, you actually see these corresponding changes and prompting of, you know, neuroplasticity to these areas that undergo these deficits otherwise.
I'm sure there are some people out there who will say, oh, Dr. Loaysa, I just want to download an app. It'd be a lot easier.
But yeah. And I will say on the mental exercise front, you know, this is, again, this isn't my main area of research, but I have a lot of colleagues who do this work. And it is very attractive to think about, like, I can play this app that I'm having fun with anyway and reduce, you know, the likelihood that I have cognitive problems when I'm older. You know, that's a very attractive idea. And it also kind of squares with, you know, our intuition about, like, use it or lose it. Like, you know, I want to make sure that I can do these things that I find valuable cognitively later on and when I'm older. So I better keep it up now. And I, you know, we observe that there are plenty of older people in our lives and otherwise who seem very with it, like that they don't have any deficits whatsoever. And so we think, oh, but look how engaged they are and they're going to museums and stuff. So we detect that there's this correlation there. And there is, even in the research, that people who do mental exercise kinds of activities and cognitively demanding activities do also tend to be the people who have the highest cognitive abilities. But as we tell our students over and over, the correlation does not equal causation. And so it could be that there's a relationship there because mental exercise has a causative role to play in cognitive abilities, but it could also work the other way around, that people who have high cognitive ability are just more likely to engage in mental exercise. And so again, this work relies to really establish a causative role of mental exercise. It relies on intervention, just like the physical exercise studies. And what ends up happening is that what's uncontroversial is that, you know, if I play Duolingo a lot, I'm going to get good at Duolingo. You know, that's great. If you play Sudoku a lot, you're probably going to get good at Sudoku. But we usually play these games with the intent that it's going to help me find my keys in the morning, right? Like, we want to be able to find where we misplaced our classes and stuff. And so though that we call that transfer. And so we want to see that kind of far transfer, that the things that we think intuitively that my brain is like a muscle and I need to train it, that's going to other kinds of things like finding my keys in the morning are also going to be benefited because that involves my brain. So it's a very logical assumption. It's just that what ends up happening is that the evidence for that far transfer is way more shaky. It's just more tenuous, I think, than, you know, just the improvements that you get to the actual task you're training on. And so that's why I tend to be a bit more skeptical. You know, there are more positive studies out there, but we also know that just like a lot of other areas of science and psychology, is that positive results tend to be published more often and get, you know, the most citations and stuff. So this sticks out the most. And so I think, you know, I don't find that the evidence is quite as strong as for mental exercise compared to physical exercise.
I did answer your question.
No, you did not. You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood.
What you're saying, it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Is there anything novel on your sort of plate right now that you're excited about moving forward? Is there a grant proposal? Are you thinking about coronavirus-related memory, cognition work? Where are you at today?
Yeah. So this work that I was telling you about, this sort of fundamental interest I have in conscious recollection of this mental time travel that we do in source-based memory, trying to remember these details and so on, that has now sort of taken shape in a different area, a different project that I have starting up with colleagues at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, because my colleagues there, Chris Walheim and his student Paige Kemp and some of his other students too, they're really interested in memory as well, but in particular, updating your memory, particularly in situations where you've received misinformation. So we can kind of think about this in terms of fake news, you know, which has been a hot topic the last few years.
The last five years.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah. And this is relevant, too, from an aging perspective for me as well, because, you know, there's a good amount of work out there showing that older adults tend to be the people who are most often sharing fake news, you know, on social media. So there's this recent review by Nadia Brashear and Daniel Schachter about how in the 2016 election that people who are over the age of 65 were the ones who are sharing seven times more links to political fake news compared to younger adults.
Wow.
On Facebook. And that adults over 50 were overrepresented among super sharers on Twitter. So they were responsible for over 80% of fake news shares. So this is crazy. I mean, there's obviously sort of this link. It doesn't mean, again, that all older adults always share fake news and younger adults never do. But we just see this sort of increased propensity for older adults to share fake news, regardless of their political ideologies or, you know, the fact that, well, let's say, you know, Aunt Sally is sharing a lot of things on Facebook anyway, compared to maybe younger adults. But it's like even controlling for those kinds of things, they still tend to be the ones who are sharing more fake news overall.
But what, so how does this, you said memory updating, misinformation, memory updating. Tell me, so what is the hypothesis? What does this mean in terms of all these folks, older folks, especially sharing this misinformation? How does that then affect this memory updating? What does that mean?
So as you can, especially as a social psychologist, you probably have a lot of ideas of social psychological reasons why older adults might do this. But from a cognitive perspective, we do know, as I was saying before, that constructs like long-term episodic memory and abstract reasoning tend to decline in healthy older age. But in particular, this sort of thing that I've been talking about conscious recollection and source memory and things of that nature, you know, there are, you know, we've seen age-related deficits in these domains as well, and that could be playing a role in this increased likelihood for older adults to share misinformation. So, for example, if, you know, I see some headline or something, and that's sort of something that sticks in mind, as that item, that specific item, piece of information that I have, it's quite relevant to be able to know, did that come from Breitbart or Snopes, or to remember, you know, where it was that I had learned that information. So the original context, the original source of that information. And this speaks to this idea of things being meaningful versus arbitrary, because it might not be, you know, the case that you know, that this is something that sticks out in your mind as meaningful just because it came from a specific source. Like, it could have come from Snopes or BBC or from a lot of different domains. And so it's important that you're able to kind of retain these details when kind of making these decisions about considering the source of where this information comes from. And then also trying to remember other associated details, like did Snopes tag it as false? You know, Snopes.
But these are all the factors that we already know. As you age, you get worse at.
Yeah, these sort of details associated to this information tends to be less available to older adults than younger adults. And so that's going to have an impact on the fact that, you know, if they aren't able to recollect these specific details, the specific source of the information, then all they're left with is the item, that piece of information itself. And it can be very familiar to you, and something can be sound very consistent with what you already believe and have a high degree of fluency, let's say. And so you don't have these sort of associated details to be like, wait, that was wrong. You know, that Snopes flagged that as false, you know, to have that detail alongside that piece of information. And then there's also this other thing is that, especially in our news media, things are often repeated at us, sometimes from the highest office in the land, you know, over and over again. and this is bad too for older adults, because there's this ironic effects of repetition finding, where, you know, just repeating things over and over, you know, especially if you repeat the misinformation, but be like, it's false though, but it's misinformation. For younger adults, they're going to be more likely to reject that, because that repeated misinformation, but with the tag of false, with that detail, just sort of helps them to remember, yeah, that information, that those associated details make me reject that information. Whereas for older adults, they have this ironic effect of repetition, where it's actually the opposite, that just sort of increases that familiarity signal. And so it makes them all the more likely to find that information believable.
Even if you think you're doing the right thing by saying it and then stressing how incorrect it is, you're really potentially not doing that. You may actually say, ironically, be reinforcing it as a memory downstream for folks.
But that is actually the perfect lead-in to the work that I'm going to be doing with Chris Walheim and Paige Kemp, because
that was my plan all along.
You would conclude that that's a perfectly natural thing. And there's research suggesting that, you know, because we sort of have this familiarity backfire effect, that repeating the misinformation might not actually be a good thing, even if you're saying to correct it, because what you're sort of dealing with then is people have these different things floating around and they can't distinguish between, you know, what's true and false. And so you have this continued influence of that misinformation, then maybe you shouldn't mention it ever. As soon as it's been out there and it's been corrected, now try to pretend it never happened. But they had this research that was just published this year in Psych Science about how maybe what we need to be doing is not necessarily not ever saying the misinformation again, but just reminding people when presenting the correction of what the misinformation was. So they call it reminding, where it's like you give people a reminder about what they had seen before that was misinformation, and then say, so that was the misinformation, but here's the correction. Here's what it actually is, what the true information is. And what they showed in this research is that when you remind people of that misinformation when presenting its correction, that you actually improve the accurate recall of the correction and even its believability compared to not reminding them. And this worked particularly well, reminding worked particularly well when people could recollect that change, that they could go back and be like, oh yes, I remember what the misinformation was, and I remember that it was corrected. And here, you know, they can actually draw that link between what was presented as misinformation and what was the correction. So it's sort of a caveat to this thing about, not repeating it ever. It's just sort of what you do to try to remind people of this sort of contiguity between, what they learned initially and its correction. And so what we're trying to do is try to see in this future project about look into the effects of reminding in older age. So can older adults also show this benefit of reminding in sort of fake news context for updating their memory? And it is also important from a, you know, this recollection versus familiarity sort of spin that I've had in my work as well, because maybe this sort of, this repetition of the misinformation or in its reminding might differently influence these processes in older adulthood.
It's really interesting. I really look forward to seeing how that turns out for you. This is an area that I'm just intrinsically interested in, the way in which our information has been spun and the way in which we're so there are no facts anymore. There are just, this is what I believe and you can believe what you want to believe. And it used to be about very specific things, maybe something like religion, that you could imagine that made sense to say you believe something. But now it's about like just something, it's about issues that are just so much more factual and data-based, and it just doesn't seem to have any reality anymore. And we've come to this point where anything that we can do to make hopefully people better at this, I think, is exciting.
There's a lot of things that I think are really important that, you know, social psychologists like yourself are doing too, to sort of tackle it from a different approach. And so I think it's just going to require that, is that it's a very complex problem that will need a complex solution.
All right, Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on today. I really enjoyed talking with you. We covered a range of ideas and topics, and I had fun.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Philip, for the opportunity. Thanks for what you do.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure, and stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
And thank you once again for checking out the Understanding Our Place in the World podcast. This podcast was produced by the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. Make sure to check us out again, as we'll have another interview for you to enjoy in the coming weeks.